Morning. We've been playing with the five skillful habits, and you may have noticed that we've left two until this morning. There are a couple of reasons for that. We had room for three yesterday, being one. The other reason is that they fall into, interestingly, two different ways of being. If you think about the three that we talked about yesterday, they tend to be how we connect with the world. Mortality, mortality, generosity, and boundaries are all associated with how we engage with the world. The other two, right speech, mindful speech, mindful consumption, are how we engage with ourselves. The other reason is that there's a fascinating history associated with the development of the way we think about them. And I'm going to share that with you in the next few moments. It starts about 3,000 years ago. And it starts, I won't take you all the way from there to here. And it starts with an observation by a German philosopher, Karl Jaspers, who noticed that the origins of virtually every philosophical tradition that we have now began in that period. And it sort of spanned the space between about 900 BCE to about 100 or 200 BCE. And he referred to that as the Axial Age. What's interesting is that four particular civilizations begin to develop at that time, and the way they thought about things are the way that we continue to. One would be the Greek, and that we tend to think about things in terms of logic. The other would be in the Mideast, the Hebrew prophets, who introduced us to essentially monotheism, but not only that, introduced us to a set of laws that connect the transcendent being to how we behave, which is the basis for our modern legal system. And then, of course, there were the Chinese and Confucius, who introduced us to the idea of obligation, living with family, but also, interestingly enough, introduced us to a sense of empathy to the Golden Rule. So the origin of the Golden Rule also occurred, and supposedly was Confucius' first idea, right guy. And finally, and this is more of interest to us, it introduced us to a way of thinking about ourselves, and in some sense, trying to sort through what the self was that began to be explored in this Indian subcontinent and eventually became Hinduism and Buddhism. Now, what's interesting about that is that much of the exploration about what the self was trying to discover it so that somehow you can engage with it differently, and that was with the sense that we were going to stop this constant coming back and being reborn. We all know this, and the suffering and suffering and suffering. And so a lot of the actual energy was put into trying to sort through what the self was all about so somehow we can engage with it differently, we can engage with ourselves differently, so we could become enlightened. Now the fascinating thing about all of this, it really is fascinating, is that all of this started when we begin to recognize those thoughts we were having in our head were not messages from gods and demons. It all started when we began to think of what we were thinking as being ours. I give that just a bit of a kick just for a moment, because that's really important. We haven't always thought our thoughts were ours. So we begin to play with ourselves in that sense, to connect with this sense of thinking, because that is what we think of ourselves as being, only after we begin to recognize that it was our product, not the product of God's. Now, interestingly enough, we also begin to think about transcendent beings as opposed to beings in the middle of our forest, etc. So we had a different concept of God, but that's another story. Okay? But the main thing you want to remember is that all of this occurred as we were beginning to see that what we were thinking was our own. And then we begin to develop ways of organizing that in Greece, in what's now Israel, in the Indian subcontinent, and in China, that allowed us to play with those thoughts and organize ways of thinking and being that we begin to see as the right way to do it. That's also the beginning of all these differences, the right way to do it. Now, what's really important is that there was one individual who stepped aside from that and said, I don't think that's the way it works. In other words, this idea of the self being inherent in our thoughts and being separate and being me, he said, I don't think so. Because I've spent a lot of time looking at this very, very intensely, and that's not what I see. What I see is that that self, those thoughts, are also constructed. They're not something that's inherently me. They are things that develop in my relationship with the world around me. That was 2,500 years ago. So what he said is, it is to some extent incorrect to see this self and these thoughts that I call myself as being a permanent entity that represents me and just me. Now that's important, because that says that this ego, this thing that I think that I am, and my trust in those thoughts is probably not correct.
Could you repeat that, please?
Sure. I'll try to. I'll repeat something like it. How about that? These thoughts that I usually refer to as myself are constructs. They're made up of my dynamic relationship with the world. Okay? They're embodied in my process of connecting to the world. And to some extent, we co-create them. So the world creates my thoughts, and I create the world through my thoughts. And that was revolutionary, because it takes us away from seeing ourselves as this really kind of wonderful person who's in charge of what's going on, who actually is in control of my thoughts, and my thoughts are essentially logical. It takes it away from that. Now, interestingly, 2,500 years later, cognitive scientists have said, you know, this... Now, we often, and of course I'm talking about the Buddha, we often talk about the Buddha as knowing all this. He didn't know this, of course. But what he knew is that if I look very carefully, everything flows through my mind. And if we've ever sat for very long, we recognize, if this is what I think and this is what I am, I'm not very happy. Because the stuff that goes through my mind is in the main quite strange, and often very trivial and unpredictable. I can't even, when you say, could I repeat that? I didn't know what I was going to say before I started. And when I start again, I'm not quite know what I'm going to say next time. We're all like that. Try to think of your next words. You can't do it. Okay? So that observation, which he made 2,500 years ago, leads us to this tremendously powerful understanding that thoughts are not necessarily facts. And so when you come to the question of what's happening, or where you're trying to be upset, or you're having non-judgmental awareness, what you're really beginning to do is to notice that what's coming up in my brain as a thought is a supposition. It's based upon what's going on right now between my body and the world. It is not necessarily something that represents reality. So the analysis of all of these thoughts that we tend to do when we're sitting in meditation takes us away from the real purpose, which is to notice, watch how they come and go. They always do. Even those terrible ones that says you can't do anything right, they come and go. And they're not necessarily facts. Probably not facts. So just a very simple example of how that embodies itself is I go on a bicycle trip. I find myself way over my head. I'm sitting in front of this bicycle tour guide, who I think is a Buddha, and somebody asked him, because I don't have the courage. Remember, I don't have much courage. I don't have the courage to ask him. Someone says, how do you get up that hill? How do you make yourself do it? And then we all go to those affirmations. You just make yourself know it. You know you can do it. He said, you count one for the first pedal, two for the second pedal, until you get to the end. what I do. And what he's saying is that thinking my way through it won't get me up it. Noticing what my body will do, because each time the pedal goes down, I'm one stroke up. It goes down again, I'm one stroke, another stroke further up. It goes down again, I'm another stroke further up, until I can't do it anymore, and then I can't do it. Telling myself I can or cannot do it has nothing to do with it. Okay? And typically, if you're like me, I'm going to tell myself as soon as I get on that bicycle, I can't do it. Okay? Because that, in many ways, is what many of us do. So what we want to remember is that the body knows when it can do it if you just listen. And the thoughts that are talking to me about what the body's doing are often irrelevant. So the Buddha didn't say that I shouldn't think. What the Buddha said is, you can't trust what you think. So you have to sit with yourself and be prepared to look at yourself clearly and honestly and do it over and over again as things become clearer. And it's embedded in how I actually act, not how I think about acting. Okay. That's an incredibly important takeaway. 3,000 years ago, we stopped believing that gods were these, that our thoughts were because of the gods telling us what to do, and we said, oh, it's me. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha said, no, it's not. And then we've had to work on all of that until now, until the cognitive scientists are caught up. So if thoughts aren't facts, it doesn't mean that I shouldn't pay attention. It just means that I shouldn't Velcro to them. They're going to come and go.
Could you repeat that one, please?
I shouldn't Velcro to them. I shouldn't stick to them. They're going to come and go.
Just listen and let it flow. Don't worry about it.
Now, the other part of this is consumption. Because that goes right along with saying that I'm an independent person and no matter where I am, I can be me. Well, psychologists have known for years that's not true. Where I am creates the me that I'm going to present. It's interchange with the world. It's going to actually be what connects me to myself independent of what I want it to be. And that's really important because the communities we choose create the people we are. We like to think that's not true. But it is. I mean, the way we think, it works in a very insidious way. If I make a decision, then what I'm likely to do, and this guy by the name of Thesinger about 60 years ago, a psychologist said it, what I'm likely to do is to create the data to support that decision independent of whether or not that decision is good. And that's chronicled in a nice little book called Mistakes Were Made But Not By Me. As you might tell, it's an easy read but not a pleasant one. In other words, this idea that I have this independent self that can go out there and make sure I am going to just be me is a fantasy. More brutally, that's been demonstrated in the so-called Stanford studies, which essentially a psychologist, I think he just wanted to see what happened, took some very nice young people, young men mostly, who just needed a little bit of extra money, and he divided them into prison guards and prisoners. Okay? You know the study. And so you also know that during that period of time, each person took on the characteristics without anybody interfering of what that role demanded and became quite cruel or quite passive and quite driven, quite beaten, okay? What you don't know is that the person who eventually, the psychologist who eventually became the person who was most connected to burnout research was a graduate student at the time, and she came to the experiments halfway through, looked at Zimbardo, was the psychologist's name, and said, what are you doing? That's cruel. And that's the first time he saw it, because the thing that's not said in those experiments is that he and his colleagues also were embedded in the process, and they also couldn't see it for what it was. Okay? It wasn't just that the prisoners and the guards became prisoners and guards. He became immune to seeing what was in front of him until a Buddha walked in and said, "What? What are you doing?" Okay? And he immediately stopped. So, and by the way, in his book that he writes about this, he said it was so wonderful and she was so powerful, of course, married her. And hopefully she keeps him on track. But, so in essence, what we're now recognizing is with these two things, skillful speech and mindful consumption, we're talking about the important ways we deal with the world so that we can stay connected to a way of being that's compassionate, that involves loving kindness, that essentially is level, and really just begins to connect with how to be. Okay? Because if we don't stop and pay attention and question, is this real? Is it true? Is this what's really happening? Then any of us are going to spend time spinning in this place where we're really saying, "I'm sure this is right," when in fact it probably isn't. So that's why those two are linked together, because they are linked together. And so if we want to be able to connect in a way with ourselves in a way that is as clearly honest as possible, we also have to be in communities that help us do that. It's very hard to do this outside of community. And it's very hard to do this, and often the communities we have to live and work in. And so that's what I leave you with. Making these changes is a community effort, not an individual effort. Seeing clearly requires engaging the community in a way that supports seeing clearly. Most of the places we are would prefer we not see. And truthfully, we're not immune to not seeing. So it's humbling to understand what the Buddha told us. And it's humbling to know how right he was. But it's also, to some extent, affirming, because it says, "I can't do this alone." We've established a community here. It's been beautiful. And you've noticed that the practicing together has given us each a space just to look deeply into our own ways of being. And may that continue.